Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Hampton Sides. He's a historian. He's the author of 5 books, the latest of which is Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. And he'll be speaking about the book tonight, Thursday the 27th of May at 5 o'clock at Santa Fe Prep School. It's a benefit for that school. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. Mm-hmm. We've had you on several times for some of your previous books. This is an amazing book about the stalking of Martin Luther King by James Earl Ray. Let's just get one thing out of the way first. You basically come to the conclusion that there was not a giant conspiracy with all the conspiracy theories that surround the assassination of every famous person. There was not a conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King. Is that right?
Well, I think that there were probably multiple bounties, multiple people who wanted King dead, probably multiple conspiracies that were swirling out there. But in this case, James Earl Ray was working either by himself or in a small, very crude kind of conspiracy. I leave a lot of doors open for who might have helped him, people he might have encountered along the way, bounties that he might have known with and hoped to connect with. But the evidence against Ray was pretty overwhelming. When he plea bargained, he admitted to everything. He admitted to, not only to killing King, but yes, he bought the scope and the rifle and the binoculars, and he came to Memphis and he checked into that grimy flop house a few hours before the assassination. And he left the scene of the crime 1 minute afterwards in this getaway car, the white Mustang that everyone had had seen. He admitted to all of that, and 3 days later, after he plea bargained and got a life sentence, he recanted part of his testimony. He said, all right, it's true, I did all that stuff, except for the
pulling the trigger.
That was this mysterious guy named Raul, who he was never able to identify what he looked like or where he lived or what his nationality was. This mysterious Raul was enough to send a lot of people on goose chases for the rest of Ray's life, and including members of the King family and including members of the inner circle of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I came to the conclusion after studying all this stuff that he was sort of Ray's imaginary friend, another alias in a whole criminal career making up aliases. He had 39 aliases over the course of his lifetime. He had what seemed like the beginning of multiple personality disorder, because sometimes he so thoroughly inhabited these identities that he had that he changed his personality and his dress and the way he behaved. So I think that Raul was just a fiction. And it took me, this research that I did for this book nearly gave me an aneurysm. It's like 50 pages of notes in the back that you'll see. I could have probably spent the rest of my life, churning through this stuff. There's so much stuff out there. But that's the conclusion I came to. Crude conspiracy, but that Ray did it.
So why did James Earl Ray hate black people in general and Martin Luther King specifically?
Well, I don't think that his racism is the single explanation for the crime. I mean, I think that with Ray, what you really have is an unbalanced person, a lost soul, someone who had some mental illness, someone who was a sociopath, a career criminal, with behavior that was accentuated by long-term use of amphetamines, who had this sort of cluster of sub-motivations. Yes, he was a racist. Yes, he was volunteering for the George Wallace campaign, 68. Yes, he considered himself a hustler, a businessman, and I think he hoped to make money off this. He didn't do anything without making some money somewhere. And I think that he hoped to get paid for this one. But I think also, within the lore of the Ray family, he was the He was supposedly the smart one. He was the ambitious one. He was the one that was going to make big things happen. And this is not a genius family by any means. He's got his two brothers, Daryl, and his other brother, Daryl. Was that a Bob Newhart show or something? John Larry Ray and Jerry Ray, who, by the way, you know, we're talking about the crude conspiracy. I'm quite convinced they were involved in one way or another. But within this family, he was the smart guy. He was gonna make big things happen. And so you kind of put all these little sub motivations in the blender, and you kind of begin to understand some of his actions. But the thing is, I think all writers, all of us, whenever a crime like this happens, we want the magical explanation for why he did it. When in fact, it's an insane act. It's irrational. It's an irrational act of violence. So I never found that sort of magic switch that went off that said, today I will, you know, kill Martin Luther King. It was something that proceeded from weeks and months of travels. And I need to explain, when he killed Martin Luther King, he had already been on the lam for a year, having escaped from a maximum security prison in Missouri, trying on all these different lives for himself, different identities. And he didn't immediately set out to kill King, although in prison he had told people that the killing King was going to be his retirement plan. And he called King Martin Lucifer Coon and various other nicknames. So really the first third of the book describes kind of his evolution from prison to the day he sets foot in Memphis.
I mean, he was pretty good at breaking out of prison. He escaped twice, once before the assassination and once after, from maximum security prisons.
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of people think that Ray's stupid, and he's not stupid. He's got a very particular kind of intelligence. He's cunning, he's crafty, he plans, he plots, he's a voracious reader. He reads the papers, he knows the news, he knows what's going on. He makes a lot of stupid mistakes in the heat of the crime. But this guy was not stupid, because he did break out of two maximum security prisons. And, you know, I think the commonly thought that he must have been too stupid to pull this crime off, but that was not my sense of him at all. This was somebody who, you know, is above average intelligence, not very educated. That's for sure. He was not educated at all. His writing was poor. His spelling was atrocious, you know. But he was not this sort of bumbling hillbilly that I think people have made him out to be.
It is kind of striking and a little bit scary that although, you know, he actually assassinated Martin Luther King and nobody else did, there was a pretty striking similarity between the way he felt about King and the way a lot of people, from, you know, members of the FBI to legislators to a large chunk of white America, also felt.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And in that sense, I guess I am kind of a uber conspiracists. You know, I believe that the culture of the times in the late 60s, there was so much hate, there was so much poison in the air. There were so many people who did hate King and who talked about King in such disparaging ways that it created an environment where someone like Ray, who was a lost soul but also ambitious, would feel like history would smile on his crime, and that he could pick up a rifle and take aim. And that it, in a sense, would be kind of like a noble act. Hoover was one of the more conspicuous haters of King, and he had really spent, ever since King came on the scene back in the 50s during the Montgomery bus boycott, Hoover had been trying to ruin him and trying to, you know, send his field agents out to spy on him and eavesdrop. And
J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI.
Yes, J. Edgar Hoover. It was a personal hatred that he had that had to do with, you know, I guess he was a racist. He certainly thought King was a communist and a subversive. And then he found out about some of King's extracurricular activities and was both shocked and at the same time sort of titillated by the reports that he was getting.
About
King's philanderings
affairs
and stuff. And, you know, some of these may have been exaggerated. Some of them may have been made up entirely. But King did have some mistresses and some encounters along the way. That's absolutely true. Hoover tried to use this stuff to ruin King. He tried to, like, plant it with various newspapers, but no one would take the bait. He also had his agents send a kind of a greatest hits tape of various recordings from hotel rooms and sent it to the Kings. Coretta actually opened up this package. And, they were clearly trying to smear him and actually get him to either resign from his post or commit suicide or get out of the way in some way. There's no question about the fact that Hoover hated King, and this was kind of a lifelong campaign of his. But it wasn't just him. I mean, you know, it was by the late 60s, King was viewed as quite radical. He had taken a very clear position on Vietnam, one of the early critics of the war, and he'd made a lot of enemies. I think that the simplicity of the civil rights movement, which was, you know, a very clear wrong that needed to be righted, and there was a simplicity and a kind of a beauty to it, had begun to fray a little bit. But in the late 60s, the movement was taking different directions. There was a lot of people who thought King had kind of lost his touch and that nonviolence wasn't going to work anymore. And then there was all these sort of young radicals like H. Rat Brown and Stokely Carmichael who just thought King was a has-been, basically, and that whole approach of his wasn't going to work. So King was in his last years considered, he was worrying that he was going to be outflanked by all these things. Meanwhile, he's getting death threats. He's traveling constantly. He's smoking more. He's drinking more. He's really stressed out, and it's a very different Martin Luther King than the one that I think most of us are familiar with.
We're talking to historian Hampton Sides about his new book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. At the same time, also, Martin Luther King was broadening the work to really include a scathing and, I think, very lucid critique of American militarism and poverty, the poverty that we have in this country, critiques which are sadly as applicable today as they were then.
Oh, absolutely. This last campaign of his life that he was working on when he was killed was called the Poor People's Campaign. And he was going to go to Washington with a poor people's army, he called it. Not just African Americans, but from all backgrounds. And the idea was they were going to build a giant shanty town on the Mall and protest systemic multi-generational poverty. And, kind of as an alternative to the rioting that had been going on in the previous summers. And, of course, that tied into his criticism of the Vietnam War because all this money and effort and energy that was being expended in Vietnam was taking away from the Great Society programs that LBJ had initially proposed. He wanted a kind of a Marshall Plan for the inner cities, and he wanted a guaranteed minimum income. He talked about universal health care, a lot of issues that have a lot of currency today. But yes, this made him a lot of enemies. A lot of people thought this was socialism, if not communism, and that he was talking about a radical redistribution of wealth in this country. And it's one thing to say we want the right to vote or we want the right to public accommodations, but it's a whole other thing to say you want rich people to give up their money and move it around to the lower classes of society. So, of course, this was enormously controversial, all leading up in the spring of 1968, when he gets this call from a friend who's representing garbage workers in Memphis who've gone on strike. He decided to come support the garbage strike because it was the perfect local illustration of what he was trying to do in Washington. And so before he could make the right turn into Washington, he made this left turn into Memphis to represent these guys who were essentially field hands from the Mississippi Delta who'd moved to Memphis to become garbage workers. And that's where he got killed. That's how he got killed.
How do you reconstruct James Earl Ray's movements and his decision to kill King and the buying of the gun and all of that stalking leading up to the assassination?
Well, the first thing I do is I call him by whatever name he's calling himself in this particular part of the narrative.
Which I find fascinating. Why did you do that?
Well, it seemed right to me at the time. It seemed to get at the fundamental sort of incoherence of his identity, you know, that he has all these names and all these personas, and that on some fundamental level he doesn't know who he is. He's calling himself Eric Galt, though, consistently through this year when he's on the lam. I wanted to also underscore how hard it was to find this guy, because I think a lot of people wondered, well, what was the problem with the FBI? Why couldn't they catch this guy, James Earl Ray, like right off the bat? They weren't looking for James Earl Ray. You know, they were looking for a host of different aliases, and then they finally figured out they were looking for Eric Galt. So for a little while there, they're really pounding the pavement looking for this guy, Eric Galt, who doesn't exist. And then they finally figure out, 3 weeks after the assassination, that the guy they're really looking for is James Earl Ray.
Through fingerprinting.
And by the time they figured it out, he's already changed his name again.
Yeah.
He's always morphing into somebody else. And that's what I think Raul was, too, by the way. You know, it's just like, as soon as they got him pinned for the crime, then he says, no, this guy named Raul did it. He's always changing. And I describe Ray kind of like a squid. You know, he's this guy who squirts out this ink, this cloud of ink around him. And it's a sort of a self-defense mechanism. He doesn't want people to figure him out. And you're kind of poking around in there trying to find him and wondering, is he telling the truth? What part is false? What part is true? As soon as you think you got a beat on him, he's gone. And he's changed his name, he's changed his location, and he's changed his story. And he did that. They played that game all the way to the day he died. And I think he's still kind of chuckling in his grave because people are sitting around trying to figure him out.
Right.
But I do, you know, to answer your question, I deconstruct his movements from Los Angeles. He moves to Atlanta, Georgia. He has no connection to Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, he does, as far as we know, he doesn't know anyone there. But he gets a flop house there, and he buys some maps, and one map was found in his flop house that had King's house circled and the location of his church and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, he goes and buys this high-powered weapon, a .30-06 with a scope on it. He goes to Selma, Alabama, on a night that Martin Luther King is scheduled to give a talk. And then he finally ends up in Memphis when King is scheduled to return to Memphis. It was given a lot of publicity in the local papers, not only where he was going, Memphis, but precisely where he was staying, the Lorraine Motel. So it was public knowledge where King and his group were. So I kind of, as we get closer to the assassination, I think the story becomes more day by day, hour by hour, and then minute by minute, you know, in the minutes leading up to when the shot rings out.
And one of the extraordinary things was that Memphis that night, for a lot of reasons, before the shooting of Martin Luther King, was a police state. There were police everywhere. James Earl Ray pulls the trigger, kills him, and then drives away. Mm-hmm. Drives away in his car.
Well, it was really more National Guardsmen than anything, because there had been a riot a couple of days before. Martin Luther King was leading a march down Beale Street, which is, you know, the historic avenue of the blues, when a riot broke out. And he was hugely criticized for this, for essentially leading a riot. He called himself a nonviolence apostle, and here he is leading a riot, a march that turns into a riot. So he had to come back to Memphis to kind of redeem his reputation. It was not a very well-planned thing. Some local thugs started rioting, and obviously had nothing to do with King. Except that it had really tarnished his reputation. So that's why he'd come back to Memphis, but that is also why there were so many National Guardsmen around. And policemen who were there spying on not only King and his group, but a local kind of black power organization that's called the Invaders that was staying at the Lorraine, negotiating with King about various things. And so there was cops all over the place watching. What they were watching out for was trying to get some intel about when the march was going to happen and whether or not there was going to be violence again. They weren't really there to watch for an assassination. They weren't thinking about that. And so when the shot rang out, what do? They all race towards the Lorraine, away from the shot, you know, towards, you know, they go because they want to find out where the shot came from. Is King all right? What's happened here? But it's sort of a natural human instinct, I think, to race towards the victim. But once they got there, they realized that they were kind of running in the wrong direction. And, you know, Ray was able to get out of there by a matter of seconds. I mean, it was so, you know, if he had come out of the flophouse 30 seconds later, he would have been caught with this weapon in his arms.
Right.
And it would have been over. But what happened was he came out, he saw a cop car, and he ditched his rifle on the sidewalk, jumped into his Mustang, and drove off and just made it. The police examine this bundle that's been left, and then they realize that this is the murder weapon that had been just then ditched by a guy described as a well-dressed white man who headed north on Main Street in a Mustang. You know, they combed the streets of Memphis, and everyone who had a Mustang was stopped. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've met who said they had Mustangs back then,
right.
Who were stopped, or any sort of white car that was stopped. But he somehow got across to the border of Mississippi. Tennessee, the way Memphis is situated, is sort of right on the border of Mississippi and Arkansas. So he somehow got out of the state of Tennessee quickly, which was not hard to do. And once he did that, he made a beeline on back roads to Atlanta, where he ditched his car. And it was found about 2 weeks later.
We're talking to historian Hampton Sides about his new book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. And so what happened next? He was not caught so quickly.
You know, I think if he hadn't been caught in those first few seconds, it was going to be hard to catch him. He made it to Atlanta. He ditched his car. He got a bus to Toronto, which was, you know, easy to do back then. There were no passports or anything. You just crossed the border. Once he got to Toronto, he started working on getting a new alias. And people think, well, gosh, this is so sophisticated. This proves that there's a giant conspiracy. How do you get aliases like this? Well, what he said he did, and what it was later shown and proven that he did, was that he went to a library and looked through back issues of the newspaper and found birth notices of men or boys who had been born in his year, his birth year. He got a bunch of names, and names of the mother and the father, and then he wrote to the registrar of births in Ottawa and got a duplicate birth certificate saying he had lost his. They sent it immediately, no problem, cost $2. And on the basis of a birth certificate, that's all he needed to get a passport. He suddenly was a new person. It was as simple as that. In Canada, they had an expression, welcome to Canada. We believe you.
Oh, my goodness.
And since the Ray case, they've actually, shortly afterwards, they changed their laws and made it a lot more strict in terms of how you get your paperwork and your identity and your passport. But so that's how easy it was for him. He became a new guy named Ramon George Sneyd and boarded a plane for London.
And there he lived in London. And meanwhile, the FBI, which was in a funny position because they didn't like King, but they still were obligated to find his assassin, both because that was their job and because they had to kind of prove that they weren't playing favorites or anti-favorites.
Yeah, and also because I think Hoover, you know, the reputation of the FBI was the most important thing in his life. And I think people probably would have, you know, I think he feared that people were going to say maybe he did it. So paradoxically, I think his hatred of King intensified the manhunt. Not only that, but there was rioting going on in something like 150 American cities after the King assassination. I mean, the nation was on fire, basically, and LBJ was pressuring them. The Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who was a great admirer of King, was also pressuring Hoover and was really one of the main sort of prime movers of this manhunt. So you know, yeah, I think that you kind of have this idea, or at least I did, they must be dragging their feet. They don't really want to find the killer. But in fact, If you get into the files and you see the numbers of leads that they're pursuing and the desperation that's behind this, and the gosh, I mean, the man hours and the sheer amount of shoe leather that's being expended. I mean, it ended up being the largest manhunt in American history, and it cost many millions of dollars. It used, I think it was 3,000 agents. In the end, Hoover was a bit embarrassed, though, because the FBI didn't catch him. Scotland Yard caught him. So it's a little source of humiliation on his part.
So we're talking to Hampton Sides about his new book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. So how was he finally caught?
Well, of course, I don't want to give away all the particulars because part of the fun in reading it. But I will say this. They figured out that he had gone to Canada, and the FBI asked the Canadian authorities to go back and examine all the passport applications that they had received in the preceding months and compare the photograph with photographs of James Earl Ray. And there was a constable who was working, burning the midnight oil in Ottawa, who had looked through, I think there was 250,000 applications that they had to go through by hand and by eyeball. And a week into this process, they came across an application from a guy named Ramon George Snaid. And he looked at this picture and he said, you know, this could be James Earl Ray. This kind of looks like him. He's got glasses now. His nose is a little bit shaped a little differently. He had had a nose job,
right, actually.
But yeah, that could be him. And he put it in what he called the possibles pile. But he almost didn't. Some of his colleagues said, that's not him. And he almost put it in the negative pile. They called Ottawa. They found out a little bit more about this Ramon Snaid, that there was actually a real Ramon Snaid. They called this Ramon Snaid and said, have you been traveling or anything? And he said, I've never applied for a passport in my life. That's when they realized this was a fraudulent passport, and they scoured every airline and found out that someone named Ramon Snaid had flown to London. So they told Heathrow, they told the authorities at Heathrow and the Scotland Yard authorities to be on the lookout for a guy named Ramon Snaid, and that's sort of in essence how they caught him. But it's a lot more complicated than that. There's a lot of twists and turns, and it's just extraordinary how. How close he came to making it. He was getting on a plane to go to Brussels, where he was going to hook up with these mercenary groups and go to Rhodesia, and extraditing him would have been virtually impossible.
Would you like to read a little section from the book?
Yeah. Actually, I did pick out a little thing here, which is about, which is really about the moments leading up to the assassination. I grew up in Memphis, and you know, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened in my hometown. And Memphis is very much a character in my book. The story keeps circling back to Memphis, and you know, I think it's what motivated me and inspired me to write this book in the first place, was try to understand why it happened in Memphis of all places. This is a scene from the Lorraine Motel in Memphis shortly before the assassination. King looked out over the drained swimming pool and inhaled the fresh air. The night was partly cloudy and cool, 55 degrees, and a crescent moon climbed in the sky. A slight wind blew off the Mississippi River, only a few blocks to the west, but slightly hidden behind the natural rise of the bluff. All around the Lorraine stood the old cotton lofts and classing rooms, the drab brick warehouses of South Main's industrial grid. Off to the north, the Memphis skyscrapers rose over the city, the Gothic Sterrick Building, the spectral white Lincoln American Tower, the Union Planters Bank with its revolving restaurant, 40 stories up. The downtown lights were just beginning to glitter. On the roof of the Peabody Hotel, the resident Mallards were happily ensconced in their mansion for the evening. As King took in the Memphis night, he leaned against the railing for several long minutes. He was completely vulnerable, but King had refused a Memphis police detail, as he nearly always did. I'd feel like a bird in a cage, he said. He did not believe in bodyguards, certainly not armed ones. No one in his entourage was allowed to carry a gun or nightstick or any other weapon. The very concept of arming oneself was odious to him. It violated his Gandhian principles. He wouldn't even let his children carry toy guns. In an almost mystical sense, he believed nonviolence was a more potent force for self-protection than any weapon. He understood the threats that were about, but refused to let them alter the way he lived. So no one was on the balcony to shield his movements, to shepherd him along, to survey the sight lines and vantage points, and anticipate the worst.
Hampton Sides from his new book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. So when I read this book, it is so vivid. I'm breathing and walking and smelling and seeing. It's so sensory. It reads like almost a crime novel. And in order to do that, obviously you've done an just inconceivable amount of research, but also you have to use your literary imagination to some extent.
I've certainly gotten some criticisms from people who kind of don't know what to make of this. Is it history or is it a crime novel, as you say? But, you know, yeah, the amount of work that you have to do to give it that sort of granularity of, you know, detail is, I mean, that was the hardest part of doing this book. You know, I just read that passage, I wanted to describe the atmospherics of that afternoon, that late afternoon when King emerges on the balcony. And, you know, go to Memphis at that moment in time, I went in April that afternoon to sort of see where the sun would be and, to find out what the moon was doing that day and reading the papers for the weather report and, you know, all those kinds of things. To me, that's the joy and the fun of doing a book like this, any kind of nonfiction, is coming up with those details. Imagination, I don't think I use my imagination. There's some dialogue that people have asked about, like, where does the dialogue come from? Like, how do you weren't there? Almost in every case, it comes from memoirs, you know, like Abernathy's memoir, where, yes, this is his recollection of the conversation that he had with King. They had catfish dinner just before the assassination, and they were together in those final hours. And he, in his memoirs, and also in testimony that he gave before the House Select Committee, recalled those conversations. And so everything that's a conversation is coming from some document. It's coming from some person who was an eyewitness. But this is the fun for me, though. This is to making it vivid, making it come alive on the page, and making, I think we know what happened that day. I think it's common. You know, we've seen enough documentaries. We've maybe read some accounts. But when you slow things down to hour by hour and even minute by minute, and then right at the end, it's second by second, you realize you don't know how it all unfolded. I certainly didn't. And that was the joy for me in doing this book.
There is a funny thing that I was thinking about while reading it, which is, you know, in tragedy, there's a sense of inevitability, and there's a kind of sense of foreboding and premonition. And shortly before his assassination, Martin Luther King is by the sea and looking out at a rock and singing Rock of Ages. Mm-hmm. And it was such a poignant moment. And yet at the same time, there's also this thing that comes in every kind of drama, which is, if only this little thing had been different, it wouldn't have happened.
Right,
and for example, there was a smear campaign mounted against King for staying at a white-owned hotel because he had called for a boycott, and so the next time he stayed at the Lorraine Motel, which was a black-owned motel,
but
and had little security.
But much more exposed to a sniper attack.
Exactly.
There's so many things like that. I mean, the strike didn't even need to happen in Memphis. That's the other thing. The bullheaded mayor that we had in Memphis, if we could have solved this thing in days, and King would have never needed to come to Memphis. And in the end, they did solve it, and it came down to a dime. They got a wage hike of a dime. That's what it came down to.
Yeah.
There's so many things like this that, but for this and but for that, there's certainly a lot of foreshadowing in this book. A lot of it comes from King himself, though. You have to remember he was getting these death threats all the time. He was talking more and more with his staff about the end. He was talking about his own death in sermons. He was talking about it in speeches. And then it all kind of came to a crescendo that night before he was killed when he gave that mountaintop speech.
Right.
Well, he wasn't even going to speak that night. He had a cold. He sent Abernathy to do the talk. There were some tornado warnings, so they thought no one was going to show up anyway. Lo and behold, there's 4,000 people there. And King gets the call from Abernathy, you better get down here and say something to these people. And so he comes down and gives this amazing speech, one of the most amazing speeches of his life, in which he seems to predict his own death with great pathos. And he doesn't say it's going to happen tomorrow at 6:01 at the Lorraine Motel, but he really does. I mean, it's so eerie.
I may not get there with you.
I may not get there with you, and longevity has its place. Everyone would like to live a long life, but, he also talks about threats that are out there from our sick white brothers. Almost as though he was anticipating someone like James Earl Ray. It's very strange. And, I think that's why I gave it the title, Hellhound on His Trail, is Robert Johnson's great song about sort of being pursued by death and pursued by fate and maybe by the law, depending on how you read the song. But, of course, Johnson was the great Delta bluesman who supposedly made a deal with the devil at midnight so he could learn to play guitar, but consequently he was always looking over his shoulder, or so the legend goes, for his end to come. And I think there was a real sense in which King was expected. He told his friends, he told Coretta, he told his followers that, the end could happen any day. And that was certainly true from the very beginning. I mean, he got threats, his house was firebombed, he was stabbed once. The amount of courage that he had to pursue this and to stick with this cause through all of that is staggering.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to ask you about, which is, Martin Luther King is so written about, and many of us have heard all of his recorded speeches and sermons.
Sure.
And so on, and they're fantastic, and I play a lot of them every year around the week of his birthday. And so,
yeah.
But what did writing this book do for you in terms of deepening your understanding of Martin Luther King?
Well, I've mainly focused on his last few months, which is a period of his life I think that hasn't been given as much attention as I think now that he's a national holiday, he's pretty much, we've frozen him in time in about 1963 for his dream speech or his march on Selma in 65. Not this different, slightly more radical, but more, almost like a, he was more of like an angry prophet. In the late 1960s, he'd kind of become a slightly different person. I came into this project, I guess, with a huge amount of awe for King and for his courage and for his eloquence and for the rightness of his cause. And, being a white Southerner from Memphis, I certainly came into this project with a certain amount of kind of guilt or just a feeling of being ashamed that this happened in my hometown and that, maybe our whole town was culpable in some way. I think I came out of the project with even more awe for him. I mean, because of the pressures that he was under and the grace with which he got through them and how he stuck to this nonviolence thing. He could have done so many things in those last years. He could have taken a post as a professor somewhere or gone on a sabbatical, or he got offers all the time to do all kinds of things that would be infinitely more appealing, I think. But he felt that he had to pursue this cause to the end, and it was much harder for him, much more stressful. And, to deal with these kinds of threats every day, I just can't imagine what that would do to you and how it would affect your psyche. And, I'm absolutely in awe of him, but I also, humanize him in the book. I mean, he's not perfect. He is a human being. He's not a saint. He did have mistresses, including one that night at the Lorraine Motel, which I talk about. He smoked and drank and, had issues and vulnerabilities. But everyone who's read the book has said they came away with a greater sense of King because of those flaws. Because I think there's kind of this halo glow around King that a lot of people have to make him a saint. They can't deal with him being a human being who's got these imperfections.
Well, we like to demonize and we like to sanctify people, and both James Earl Ray and Martin Luther King come off as real human beings in your book.
Mm-hmm. Although Ray's possibly multiple human beings.
Right.
I mean, I think he almost had a multiple personality disorder, and I can't say that I figured him out. He is a cipher, you know. He's a sphinx. he's a mystery.
I was thinking you've written biographies of people, and this is not exactly a biography of James Earl Ray, but you really had to get to know him. And in the process of getting to know people, we naturally develop affection for them. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine that.
No.
Well, yeah.
No, I think of him once I decided that he did do it, because I came into this project, you know, having heard all these conspiracies growing up in Memphis. I pretty much figured he was part of a giant conspiracy. That was sort of the bias that I came into the project with. It was only when I kind of looked at the hard evidence, okay, what was the case against him, that I became convinced that he did it. Once I became convinced that he did it, you know, I think I started to want to understand him, to try to understand where he came from, what were his movements, what were his habits. But there was probably a certain amount of anger that I had toward him. I mean, this guy, this creep wandered into my hometown and just ruined things, you know, for the nation and for the world, but specifically for my hometown. I mean, Memphis is still reeling from this thing. And I think if you polled the average person on the street, they would say James Earl Ray was probably from Memphis, probably this redneck from Tennessee or something. Well, no, I just was, in some ways, it was sort of an accident that it happened in Memphis and that he followed King to Memphis to assassinate him. Affection, no, he's a really hard guy to have affection for. But in narrative terms, he's like a gift that keeps on giving. You know, you never know what he's going to do next. The FBI could never figure him out. Shrinks couldn't figure him out. His lawyers couldn't figure him out. And he's always doing the unexpected, including breaking out from another maximum security prison after the
right.
assassination. So, you know, I had affection for his character, I guess, from the point of view of a writer. But you know, what a creep, you know. what a piece of work. Some people have said, as they've read the book, though, that in a perverse sense, this is kind of a convention of, I guess, of detective stories, is that you identify with the guy who's being pursued, and you want him to get away, at least to the next chapter. Because as soon as he's caught, you know the story's over. So they find themselves in a perverse way rooting for this guy that they hate. They know they hate him. They know he's creepy. But they want him to get at least through this, you know, out of this tight spot and on to the next place. So that is kind of something that happens to readers, I think, when they turn the pages.
Yeah, that I'm a not so much in your book, actually, but in detective stories and dramas, I always am hoping the bad guy gets away. And then I think, what's wrong with me? But
yeah,
that's
yeah.
part of the way this works. But I think one of the things that is so striking about it, and which I am, for some weird reason, hyper aware of anyway, is the reality that no matter how famous, enlightened, profound, educated, kind, good, useful, and everything that a human being may be, they are as subject to, as the next ant on the ground, to instantaneous violence and death.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially in our country where it's so easy to get guns, high-powered guns like this, and to kind of move in the shadows and change your name. And, you know, it's kind of the flip side of all of our freedoms that we have is that, you know, it's really easy to get around and buy a car and, you know, get a new identity and buy a Remington 30-06 deer rifle. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so hard for people to understand is that, you know, that such a hollow person as Ray can bring down such a great person like King. It's just hard to fathom. But unfortunately, we have a long and sordid history of individuals who've been able to do this. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's scarier than a conspiracy, is that any, you know, that one person can do this kind of thing and pull it off and almost get away with it. But you also have to remember King did not have, as I alluded to in the reading, he did not have any bodyguards. He didn't have a Secret Service. He was just a private citizen. There was no police detail, and he didn't allow any of his group to carry weapons. So, you know, it's like it's actually kind of extraordinary that he hadn't been the victim of at least an attempt earlier in his career.
We're talking to Hampton Sides. Now, you have been traveling all around the country and beyond talking about your book, but you were a Santa Fean at this point in your life, and you wrote this book in a coffee shop.
I did. Not unlike this one here. I have to get out of my house. There's too many distractions. I've got three kids and dog, and, you know, I don't know. The day just gets away from me. So I like a highly caffeinated bunker, you know, with music and Wi-Fi, and I can get a lot done that way. It sounds bizarre, and I don't recommend it to anyone. It would be better if I could just, you know, go to a quiet cabin somewhere and get a book done. But I think if I did that, I would end up like Jack Nicholson and just like wanting to kill someone or chop them up with an axe. You know, something about all that quiet I can't handle. Maybe a couple of days it's really sweet and wonderful, but then I need my coffee shop.
So you wrote this at the Tarts Treats.
Yes, I did. A great place. And I've got an account there. I've got my chair. I've got my, everyone knows my name. And I actually was locked in there one time. I was working so hard. I became such a part of the furniture that they locked me in. And
they forgot you. They
forgot
see
I was there.
You? Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
And now they're talking about giving me a key. So that won't ever happen again. Just stay there all night.
Well, the book is fantastic and fascinating on many levels and highly readable. It's called Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. And Hampton Sides will be speaking about the book tonight at 5 o'clock at Santa Fe Prep School. It's a benefit for that school. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to be back.
And we're going to go out with the Robert Johnson song, which was the inspiration for the title of the book. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Dave Holland. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll be back tomorrow with Robert Knott. Hasta la vista.